asking questions as we go. We'll see how that goes. I'm going to take a little bit of a detour first, just to try and set the scene as to why I think forest gardening, food forestry makes a lot of sense. Might be preaching to the choir a little bit, but anyway, we're going to take a quick look at what's wrong with normal farming. So this is a really biologically simple approach to growing food. Technologically complex. It's not really sustainable. Probably not sustainable for very long at all. It's based on a very few number of animals and plant species. So that opens it up to all sorts of problems. Generates a surplus, which is meant to be a great thing, but that requires storage, accounting, guarding, which then gives rise to social hierarchy and inequality, and obviously all the parasitic entities that come with that, banks and chemical companies and such. So this way has allowed us to grow the population and create all sorts of horrible diseases and problems. Well, we're looking for ways to move beyond this. This kind of thing, I mean, it's only possible with huge machines and fossil fuel subsidies. Destroys the life of the soil and causes deep compaction. It's environmentally degrading and energy intensive, so it's days are numbered whether we can come up with a solution or not. Pretty monotonous, ugly, boring kind of job, no regard for natural land patterns. I'm sure we can do better than this. People will say we need these kind of practices to feed the people, but you know, we're not really feeding people, are we? We're pretty much just feeding cows to feed the people most of the time. So there are other ways, and they're not new. The Aztecs had a pretty big city. It was comparable at the time. It was invaded by the Spanish. This island in the lake, Texcoco, is now where Mexico City is. So this never collapsed and disappeared. This just got overtaken and became something else. So when it was taken by the Spanish, they had about 300,000 people living here. And they didn't trade with the outside world. This was self-contained pretty much. It was rivaling Paris and Venice and Constantinople in its population. And it had been running for hundreds and hundreds of years this way. And they built all of these floating islands off the main island through this process of land reclamation using biological processes. These floating gardens called chinampas, and that fed all these people. And so farming in amongst trees and amongst the water, high levels of fertility and highly productive and easy to get your produce around in a little canoe. So that's a lot more sustainable. We don't have a lake like that anywhere near here that we can use, but there are other things.
So
just kind of looking at this is not something new, it's been done before.
We're not going to copy this, but take some ideas from here.
Horticultural societies sort of farmed and gardened and gathered, and there were a lot of them around the place,
and we're always told that agriculture was a great step forward in development, and we can't possibly go anywhere else but further forward. But it's interesting, they've discovered that cultures that were
horticultural and then became agricultural as the ideas spread out of Fertile Crescent, both the ideas where were spread and the genetics of the people involved spread and slowly overtook. But the people that adopted these new techniques generally ended up with a shorter lifespan and more diseases from degenerative diseases from repetitive work. They had more frequent and severe famines. They had less leisure time, less food diversity, and less cultural diversity as a result. So, I don't know. I think it's worth looking at this. Anyway,
I'm going to go on now and look at what is actually a food forest.
So the idea is to create kind of a harmonious natural system that is self-supporting in all its needs and doesn't require inputs from the outside of the system to maintain it, at least once it's up and running.
It could be sustainable in theory if we're prepared to accept some hard handwork,
It's biologically rich, so again, there's like lots of different insects, lots of different animals, lots of different plants all working there together. This makes it resilient to pests, to the weather, to economics, and it does take a lot of upfront work and design, but this is something that tapers off over time. And if you have lots of people involved in different elements of it, it might not make it quite as challenging.
It is a complex system, but this is what gives it a lot of its benefits. So my experience comes from working this piece of land here, which is about 1.5 hectares. We started planting it in 2011, but there were some existing fruit trees already here and some existing shelter, so that's given us quite a head start. The blue lines here is sort of like little creeks, and then the smaller blue lines up in the plantings is the swales and terraces and stuff that I've dug, and I'll
talk a bit more about that as I go along.
So it gets quite dry there because it's this raised sort of peninsula, this plateau, quite steep down to the gully. So once water runs off, it's pretty much impossible to get it back without expending a lot of energy. And this summer we have been pumping a little bit from one of those creeks just to keep doing it alive.
I want to differentiate a little bit the forest gardening from food forestry, and I see forest gardening as the production of annual vegetables in amongst a food forest.
So that's gardening on the edges, on the sunny edges, and in between some of the trees. And this can include the water harvesting features and swales and mounds, and obviously it's going to have the biological pest controls and nutrient sources. So there's a companion planting for beneficial insects and planting nitrogenous plants like beans and other legumes and keep the whole fertility cycle ticking along.
So creating a food forest, this is just from my own experiences and what I've learned. Before you start, it's probably worth thinking a bit about your overall objectives. What do you want to achieve with this project? You know, you might want to just feed yourself and your family, or maybe you want to make an income or improve the quality of your land and its value. Whatever it is, you need to give it a bit of thought, because that'll change the approach that you take, change the types of species that you might use, and whether or not you throw money at the project or just do it all yourself slowly. So another important thing to consider is restrictions that are imposed by the local climate. So things like the sun, how much sun you're getting, where the wind's coming from, your water, whether you have water, whether you need more water. Access, physical access to the location, you know, how are you going to get in and out of there with materials, and is it really, really steep? Do you need to put in tracks? And finally, markets, you know, if you're going to be selling this produce or trading the surplus, where does it need to get to? That'll dictate to a certain extent what types of things you plant. You know, not everything transports well, keeps well once it's been harvested. Or maybe you want to set up a model where people come to you and pick on demand as they want. That's definitely been done. Are you going to throw a lot of time or money at this? You know, it's quite a lot of stuff to learn. It's quite a lot of hard work setting it all up. This is, you know, in the picture here, it's only partway along. There's still a lot more planning to go. This is probably about a year ago. So there's still a lot more planning, work to be done, planting and actual plants to be either purchased or propagated. That all takes time and money, effort. So are you going to do something you want to do yourself, or do you want to employ skills, labour, and purchase plants? So it's all worth considering. Where's your nutrients and fertility going to come from? When you're setting it up, like I was, from a blank slate, which is here, there wasn't really a lot there. It was grass and a little bit of shelter there. So we introduced animals to bring in fertility, and we also were bringing in a lot of seaweed, straw, sort of thing. I'm just going to jump back to finish off here on the
Oh, yeah, the only other thing I wanted to say is, would you include animals in amongst your plantings or not? That'll, again, choose dictate whether or not you're going to have to put in fencing or, again, maybe what type of species you want to plant. So, yeah, when you start with a blank open field like this, you have more design freedom, so you can be a bit more ambitious or a bit more kind of creative about what you want to do in terms of digging and all this kind of thing. But you have fewer niches to work with, so you don't perhaps have shelter, you don't have any wet spots. These things can be developed over time. Come on, come on.
Sorry.
That's okay. So, yeah, we've done quite a bit of planting. Probably should have done more to create windbreaks. They can be added in, and we've done more of that as it's become quite evident. So anyway, that's November 2011, and so this is a kind of what it looks like now on a good day. This is November, so it looks a little bit more crispy than this now. it's worth probably pointing out too that when I started off planting out here, I didn't know about food forests or any of these ideas really. I just wanted to grow stuff and I didn't want grass, so I just started planting and have kind of morphed it and melded it into a food forest as I was kind of coming across these different techniques and different approaches for working with the plants and the space. Another important aspect, which is talked about quite a lot in permaculture, is the idea of edge. And so there's this idea and it's quite evident within certain systems that the interface between two different systems usually results in higher productivity than a few metres either side of that edge. So the classic example is the shoreline or the beach. It's highly productive and very lively environment, that interface between the land and the ocean. And the same is true between different patches of planting, and they can find this with growing alternating strips of grain. If you just grow a huge big paddock of grain, it's usually more productive around the edge. So when they do a count of like yield per square meter or whatever, they count it from the middle of the paddock. Because if you count the edge, you get a wrong reading. The edge is always more productive. So if you want to grow grain, the most productive way is to grow 2 meter strips, because that's the width of the edge of grain before it starts to lose productivity. And then, or maybe it's 1 meter, and then you grow a 2 meter strip, so you've got 1 meter inside of nothing, and then you grow a strip of something else, and then 2 meters of grain again. So yeah, we're trying to create a maximum amount of edge to get maximum vitality from the system, and also get good access in amongst those plantings. And we want to think a lot about the different interactions between the plants, their attractions, their repulsions, and the different things that they're going to contribute to a relationship, because in nature the plants grow right up next to each other. There's not this big circle of bare earth under the tree between each tree. So, this is just a good example of kind of a bit of everything. We've got a nitrogen-fixing tree in the middle. We've got a scrambling bramble thing. We've got some nitrogen-fixing clovers, and we've got some kind of fungal growth there. There's comfrey, and they're all bringing in something different to that little local cluster, that guild.
I'll talk a little bit more about guilds down the track. So there's many layers and components that come together to make up the final forest.
And this picture is used quite a lot, or something similar, and I think it shows 7 here, but
I've kind of expanded it a little bit to include a few other things. So working from the top down, I see one element is the birds, so they're coming in and they're bringing in pest control and nutrient delivery. Then you've got a canopy or climax layer, which is your big trees, large fruit and nut trees, shelter trees, maybe some big nitrogen-fixing trees. They might be timber on the edges or firewood around the edges. Then you've got climbers that climb up
these larger trees and maybe some of the smaller trees. And those low trees might be nuts, some nut trees, dwarf fruit trees, scaffold trees for climbers. And then below that you've got the shrubs, which are in berries and currants, that kind of thing.
And down below that, you've got herbaceous layer of herbs, your salad greens, nutrient accumulators, insect and habitats and nectar plants for the insects. And then you may have animals running in around there, depending upon what you're growing and what type of animals it may be compatible. We'll talk a bit more about animals a bit down the track. And then the animals bring pest control, nutrient delivery, and a potential yield in terms of meat, eggs, that kind of thing, skins. And then we've got a surface or ground cover layer, which is basically just above the soil. So it's classic one of those things like strawberries. We have aquatic or wetland areas. You may or may not have this. We have a bit of a wet area because it brings frogs and the pigs like it. Then there's a fungal component, which is pretty essential in a woodland type setting. Trees will grow best in a fungal dominated system. So we do a lot of scattering of dead branches and rotten logs and wood chips and things like that to help build up a fungal system. And then underground, you've got roots and tubers and rhizomes and worms, other helpers. So all these bits fitting together again in a multi-dimensional structure to create the end result. Something that gets overlooked, I think, a bit is setting realistic expectations. And so there's a few areas here. There's work. There's a lot of work and a lot of effort if you're doing it yourself and not, you know, throwing money at the project, and especially if you're using hand tools, which we do partly because it's more enjoyable, but also I want to prove that it can be done. I don't want to make a point and say this is the way you have to do it, but I want to make a case that it can be done this way. It's not impossible. It takes a lot of time for these systems to grow and develop. Again, it depends whether you're throwing money at it, buying big already grown trees and stuff, but all these things do take time. We can accelerate them to a certain extent by being clever and exploiting natural things that happen anyway, but it takes time. We're using perennial plants, and for the most part, which often results in less common produce. So you're growing things often in cases that you might not see in the produce aisle of the supermarket, which is fine, especially for yourself, but it can make it a bit more challenging if you're trying to sell this stuff, maybe. A lot of people don't know what a babaco is, for example. Seasonal distribution. You're relying on the seasons, and you're not importing your stuff from half around the world, so you have to put up with eating stuff when it's ready and available. So, here we go. These are the kind of tomato mutations that you might... Visual appearance of produce may not resemble the supermarket produce aisle. But these things often grow themselves. And so, if you haven't had to do anything for it, can you complain, really? You know, like, how many carrots have I pulled that I never planted, you know? Some of them look like that. Some of them are quite nice. So again, we're talking about perennials. So these are things generally that you're planting them once, and they live for a number of years, and you keep getting a yield. And maybe the yield doesn't come in year one, but somewhere along the track you start getting something back. And usually the longer it takes, you know, the bigger the yield once it starts happening. You think of a chestnut tree or something. You know, you wait a long time for it, but once it starts coming, you get chestnuts, you know, more chestnuts than you could ever eat. So, but perennials, you plant them once and they start to get back. So there's a lot of different perennials. And we've managed to get quite a lot of our annuals to become perennial, essentially, just through their own self-seeding. So the common ones, some of them I've listed there, the silver beet, the kale, all these things, we just leave some of them to go to seed. The ones that look like they were in a good location or they were nice and healthy, leave them to go to seed, let them drop or collect the seed and spread it somewhere else. And yeah, you get like a forest of silver beet or something, but just pull half them out, you know. We transplant some of them. And sometimes beans and peas will come up, tomatoes come up. So you don't have to replant everything. getting the return and a yield is pretty important. These pears were actually planted by someone else before we got there, so that's not really fair. But this list here gives you kind of an idea about the order in which you'll start to get a return. So, and your vegetables, you know, it's only a few months before you start eating what you planted, and then you've got chickens and eggs and meat that takes a little bit longer, and working down the list, you know. So we're up to about six, I think. We've had our first peaches and apricots from trees that we planted. And I imagine next year we'll get apples. But yeah, timber and nuts and timber is
quite a ways down the list. But worth waiting for. And if you don't plant it, it'll never yield. Just a couple of photos
about our early stuff, beans and tomatoes and potatoes and eggs. You can get that in year one, no problem.
What have we got next? Okay, so as I've said a couple of times, food forest is multidimensional. What does that mean? We're talking about the surface of the earth.
That's a primary dimension. This is what gets used by most people who farm. They just run animals out across the surface, or they drill it with corn or whatever. But especially in our situation where we've got a very small piece of, well, reasonably small piece of land, we're trying to maximise the value of every square metre where we can. So this is a technique, and some of you may have been at Sam's talk a while back, and he covered this a bit. So there's a technique of, first of all, in relation to surface area, we're increasing the surface area of the land, and we're increasing the edge. We're also getting the moisture retention benefits of the buried logs that sort of act like a sponge and absorb the water during the wet times, make it available for the plants later. And depending upon how they're laid out in terms of their orientation with the sun and prevailing winds, you can get little microclimates of sunny and shade. And you've got a higher spot and a lower spot. So in some of the locations where they build these, or some examples that I've seen photos of, they're huge, you know, a metre or 2 metres high. And so you get quite a distinct change in temperature between the top and the bottom. So you've got the different types of locations and microclimates and niches to plant into and exploit.
And in this particular case, and ideally they're orientated along the contours. So these are laid out on level lines, so any runoff that's moving downhill is caught in the little depression on the uphill side, which is where the dirt was scraped out from to cover the logs. The water is captured there and absorbed into the pile. And you might not think that the water really gets absorbed that much, but the capillary action will wick and draw the water up into the mound and up into the logs, and they slowly break down over time. So the top photo, I think, was July, and this is last week or something. So even just working straight from that grass was all alive. It just got ripped up and turned over, and then I've been mulching it with things like cardboard and straw and planting into it. And we've had kale and peas and stuff off there, and some of them I've planted and plan to do more of it is planting on the shady side, which is the uphill side. There's a bit of wind protection and there's a bit damper, so that's where I'll plant the trees, which will then sort of lean out over a bit and keep the sunny face for growing the annual vegetables. So that's the surface. The other obvious one is the vertical height dimension. So here we've got
trees. You can have the trees with animals underneath, you can have the trees with vegetables underneath, or you can have the trees with other trees climbing up into them. So this is a young Italian alder, which is a nitrogen-fixing plant species, with the hardy kiwi fruit climbing up into it.
And finally, time being fourth. As time goes by, the makeup of the forest and your involvement in it will change. So this is just, I just made these lines up, but just to kind of, based on my kind of feel and understanding of how it would go, you would have decreasing effort to a certain point, and then seasonal kind of undulations, and then slowly increasing output up to a certain level, and sharply increasing diversity up to a certain level, and then maybe changing slowly through time.
Other things that will change over time, of course, is the shape of the different trees as they get bigger and as you prune them, and changes to the light and shade, how the sunlight enters and how the wind enters, and where your wet spots and dry spots are, and productivity and the contribution of the various components will change over time as well, how much nitrogen they're fixing and how much leaf litter they're dropping and all this kind of thing, and the more birds that come, how much manure they've spread. And okay, I did talk quite a lot about this a while ago, so I'm just going to brush over this quickly, but one quite an important element, I think, for these systems, especially in our climate, is creating systems for water distribution and water catchment. So this again, it started off before I really knew what I know now, and this area is our kind of main annual vegetable garden, and so it started off as only vegetables, and I'm now introducing more trees and shrubs and stuff around the edges. But that was kind of good because it's allowed me to do all this digging and interfering before anything was sort of fixed in place. So here, the, off to the right of the photo, the rain from the house roof gets directed into there, and once that's full, it sort of cascades and trickles down through this network of shallow ditches, which are also the access pathways, and the water gets, I mean, that blue is just added to kind of help see what's going on, but the water does follow those pathways and gets spread around that way. So the objective here really is to make the water take the longest path, both in distance and in time, from the source to the sink. So the source is generally the highest point on the land or some hard surface like your roof or your driveway or patio or something. So get it to take the longest, slowest route, so you're minimizing erosion and allow giving it time to sink in. And importantly too, performing the maximum number of duties as it passes through the system. So getting it to go past as many different plants as possible, getting it to take with it dissolved minerals and nutrients, and ideally doing it with gravity and as minimal disturbance as possible. And again, ideally it's best done really before you start tying into it to minimize that disturbance, but yeah, it can evolve as you go. Here's another small one, narrow, more developed area. And so we've been pumping a little bit from the little stream nearby, and so we just open up the pump into here and, you know, give it an hour or so and let it fill up, and then it just slowly sinks in. So part of this strategy is changing the shape of the ground so that it can do this, but another big part of it, which is where we're focusing the effort now that this has been done, is actually improving the soil's ability to hold water. Because we're on clay, and yet it doesn't drain away fast, but it doesn't really hold a lot either. It's quite solid. So
using, I'll get into it a little bit more, but using a lot of plants to sort of loosen up the soil and crack it open and inject organic matter down in there so that it can actually absorb and hold a lot more water. So from the wet time through into the dry area. Fertility, I talked about this briefly, and so I want to go into this a little bit more detail. You know, to grow healthy plants and vegetables, you need a lot of good fertility. So this can be done by bringing in stuff from outside, and we do that as well, seaweed and straw, and we also spread around the manure from the pigs and from the chickens. We also make a compost tea, which then can be spread by hand or just drained into the swale when it's wet and spread around that way. Another common way, an easy way, is with nitrogen-fixing plants. So here's a short list, just to give you an idea that there's some available in all the different sort of layers there. There's a lot of other ones that we've been experimenting with as well. So
These plants,
for those who are not familiar with this idea, is that they're either leguminous plants or anacarizal plants that have a symbiotic relationship with fungi in the soil, and they take nitrogen out of the atmosphere and fix it into the soil so it's available to the other plants growing around.
Another good source of fertility is animals. And the general rule here is to put your animals
uphill of your planting so that, you know, any dissolved goodness can get washed down into your fruit trees. So we have ducks, or these ones actually are Muscovy geese, and they can be food, and they also, you know,
fertility and pest control. We have been using pigs.
These are kuni pigs, and they're for keeping the grass down primarily and turning the grass into manure. One thing that we've discovered this year, being so dry, before we started irrigating, they got quite hungry, I guess, and discovered that they could eat tree leaves. So we've had to sort of shut them out of some of these areas until we get the grass back. And I've been cutting willow from nearby for them to sort of supplement a bit.
But that's pretty good, because they're not huge, and you can create pretty small fences, low fences, to keep them where you need them. And
I'd like to experiment with having them tethered, but I haven't really given it a good go.
And then another one, popular one, is chicken,
of course, for eating bugs and breaking up the pest cycle, spreading nutrient,
and preparing new ground. If you can keep them
confined into a region, they'll scratch and destroy the weeds and manure it, and then you can
plant your trees into that newly prepared area. Okay, I'm going to now talk a little bit about weeds. So everybody is quite worried about weeds and getting rid of them, and
there's a good reason to get them out of the places you don't want them. But they're also performing a function,
and they're also indicators of certain things that are going on in the soil.
So the weeds, as I understand it and what I've kind of observed, the weeds fit into this process of natural succession, which starts with the disruption from a fire or erosion or landslipping or overgrazing or cultivation, where you get newly exposed ground and the weeds colonize it immediately, and their role there seems to be to send down a root network and stabilize the soil to stop it washing away, stop it blowing away, to stop it drying out, and covering the surface with a bit of a living skin so that, it can't dry out and can't get blown away, and to start repairing that location and converting it or allowing it to transition and back to the ultimate system, which is the forest, eventually, if there's no further disruption. So the common ones that we see around our place is things like the yarrow near the white flowering one, the dandelions, the chicory, plantain.
What else have we got in here? Yeah, those are the really common ones. Sometimes dock in the
wet spots. So we're quite happy for them to be in the areas where we're not trying to really grow something else.
For us, actually, our biggest weed is grass, because
it's no good for us. The pigs like it, but we only have the pigs because we have grass. So it's nice to walk on, but other than that, it's not really useful for us. So we're happy for these other things to kind of battle it out with the grass. And they all have flowers and stuff which insects live on. And the amount of things like crickets and little bugs and stuff that we're seeing now is quite amazing, and you can hear it as well, especially in the evening. It's just grass is basically humming. So yeah, the pioneers and the weeds are fast growing plants that come in and quickly colonize, send down deep roots and start building the soil, accumulating the minerals from down deep and dragging it up into their plant tissue, which then dies, falls on the surface, composts down, and slowly prepares the way for the next succession, the next step in that process, which will be smaller, shrubs and blackberries. And in our area, it's things like blackberries and barberries and thorny things like that, which then create more shade and then stop animals being able to push in there, and then we have native stuff coming up. So this idea of managing the natural succession, and this is where we can kind of come in as managers and kind of conductors of the system, and we can see where this wants to go anyway, which is, as I said, it's towards natural forests and trees. And rather than just letting it do it at its own rate, randomly, as nature kind of slowly and chaotically just stumbles along, and seeds come by the wind or on the feet of birds or whatever, we can guide it by introducing the species that we want, not only for ourselves but for the system, the greater system. So rather than putting blackberries, thorny blackberries, we might put thornless blackberries or some other thing. But we are there to guide it along that pathway, and therefore accelerate what was going to happen anyway, because we're not waiting for the time when the wind just happens to deliver the seeds. We can get them there when at the right time, just before the rain comes, whatever, and accelerate it, and not only accelerate it, but in a direction that is towards highly optimized plant interactions that support each other while creating a surplus of yield for
us and for the other inhabitants. So I talked a little bit about improving the soil to help make it hold more water. This is sort of the approach that we're taking.
We can bring in mulch from outside, things like straw and such, but it has to come from somewhere and it takes energy. And so if we can create it and grow it on site, seems to be the best way. So we're using things like these big radishes and deep-rooted fennel and dandelions, dock, anything that's kind of easy to grow, that wants to grow, that creates a lot of seed or whatever, and using that to prepare the soil, to get down deep into that clay, crack it open, and then sometimes pull it out if we want to plant something else, or just hack it off and let it rot away down in there. Actually, the main reason I pulled that one out was to see how deep does it actually go. And I had to excavate quite far to get it out intact like that. So that one might be 2 years old, but they produce a lot. It's worth realizing that there's a relationship between the amount of material that's produced above ground and the amount below ground. So, you know, the more that's above ground, generally, the more is going to be below ground as well. And when the plant grows up, if you hack it back, even if it's still alive, the roots will kind of die back and sort of self-prune as well to keep the plant in balance, so that the roots can support the top, or the top can support the roots. And so all of that material underground, that root network that's shed, dies and turns into soil and creates pathways for air and worms and water to all be able to migrate around underneath the soil. And generally like loosens things up and improves the whole situation. So we try to compost as much as possible, not quite everything, most things, and try not to burn too much, because once it's burned, it's gone, you've lost all that carbon, and it's
if you have the room, you can make big compost heaps. They can take years and just rot down and plant into them. So I already said this, but we're trying...
It's not just about creating food for people. We're trying to create a system that is there for all the inhabitants. And so it's easy to get upset when the birds come and take your strawberries. But that's kind of like a cost of doing business or something. They need to exist there as well. If you exclude all these pests, then you're fighting back nature. And every time you're fighting it, it's taking effort and work, and if you can actually allow them to fit in and fulfill their role, then they deserve a piece of pie. So, yeah, that's kind of how I see it. And so we try to encourage as many of these things in as possible. In saying that, we had a couple of wild goats turn up the other day, and I did get out the rifle. They ran away. And we're trying to get each individual element to do as many different functions as possible, just because we don't want to make a huge system unnecessarily. So if each element can perform as many functions as possible, that keeps it nice and compact and efficient, easy to manage in theory. So, you know, an example of single planting could provide a windbreak, fodder, habitats, fencing, firewood, and soil improvement just from this one, row of planting. So we're growing things for other purposes besides food. There could be a support in some ways. It's a physical support, or it's blocking the wind or something. Scaffolds for things to climb up, companions in some way with beneficial plants. And you can get fiber, you can get medicine, you can get fodder. And the sacrifice or offering to the ecosystem. So that's the plants that are there for the others to enjoy or to live off. And I mean, that photo is trying to show that too, that we leave a lot of stuff to go to seed, and some of the seed we get, some of the seeds the birds get, and some of the birds the cat gets.
So yeah, we get lots of little visitors, which is quite cool. And the other ones that are less obvious, but equally as important, maybe even more important,
you know, because they're down the bottom of that pyramid, there's thousands of these guys all doing their thing, and we don't really notice them. These beneficial insects, I think they're all beneficial. I did read somewhere that for every one problematic pest insect, there's like 1,000 other ones that are good or something, so... Anyway, we've noticed a huge increase in the types of insects, some that I've never seen before, like these shiny and orange ones. I don't know, I don't think I've ever seen them before. And they really like these umbelliferous flowering plants, so that's the parsnip and the carrot and the celery and stuff. So we grow a lot of them. And they also happen to create quite a bit of biomass and plenty of seeds. And if you grow them thick enough, you can get a little bit of shelter from it. So lots of benefits there.
Okay, different patterns for laying out your planting. I'll just go with this quite quickly.
I mean, you're pretty much free to do whatever you want, but there's some common techniques or patterns. We do quite a lot with contour because our place is sloped and the moisture is quite important.
So laying things out along contour lines, it also makes it easier to access on these slopes, get around. Another approach that we've used quite a bit is
sort of what I call bubble and cluster. So we're starting off with these individual locations. In this case, we use the chickens to kind of precondition them. We feed them there, throw the kitchen scraps there, and then plant into it, and then plant around that, and then move outwards until the bubbles kind of join together into little clusters or lines.
And guilds, I talked about this briefly, but I'll just
give it a bit more detail. So again, these are plants that work together in kind of symbiotic ways. In this particular photo, we've got in the center there, there's a nitrogen-fixing Tagacestes trilucin. We've got runner beans climbing there, hardy kiwi fruit climbing in. It's creating, or will create over time, a bit of a canopy over to help give some frost protection to a lemon, which is hardly visible there in front of the comfrey. Got a comfrey for fixing nutrient and accumulating nutrients from the subsoil. There's a rhubarb at the back there, and in the shade of the Tagacestes and down in that swale behind is a little Japanese raisin tree that needs a bit of shade and shelter when it's young. And you can see all the things hanging in there, like fennel and chicory. So these plants fit together in space quite nicely, and in time, you know, some of them, the Tagacestes might end up being cut out eventually. Nothing is static.
And just to get a bit of an idea at this, how this might
look under the ground, because you've got to think a little bit about this, you know, because the plants have a profile underground with their root systems and competing for nutrient and water and this, so. Try and take that into account as well,
where possible. Here again,
just working on the contour and a little bit of sheet mulching, which is a good way if you want to do a large area quickly, if you've got enough mulch to really kill all the grass off and you get your plants established.
Mulch. Can never have enough mulch. Yeah, I'll think more about that. It is possible to transform an existing backyard orchard, which we did with the plantings that were already there. I don't, unfortunately, have a good before photo, so this is that same guild, just to the right of that blue drum we looked at before. There's the Pegasaski and the rhubarb there, just on the right of it. And this is where the rainwater from the roof of the house comes in, so it's pretty lush.
So we just took that existing area, which was basically a big, huge lawn with apple trees and a few other plums and apricots and stuff planted in, and then made the pathways and did all the underplanting in amongst them and underneath, and have planted a few smaller things like the Tegasasni, other nitrogen-fixing trees in around there just to help with that.
And that's sort of what it looks like now. And we're almost at the end here. So when you look at setting up a food forest,
depends on the scale, but you're going to need a lot of plants because you basically want it to be solid plants. You can buy them, but it's expensive and it's hard to find what you need often. So it's good to learn how to propagate your own, which I've been doing as well, which is quite interesting. And it allows you to learn a lot about the plants, which, as I've kind of probably made hopefully clear, there's a lot to know in all of this, which makes it kind of daunting, but you don't have to know it all at the start, and there are a lot of good resources out there, obviously the internet, books and stuff. So yeah, by saving seeds and taking cuttings and grafting and budding, you can create a lot of your own plants at pretty low cost, and at the same time get exactly what you want and learn a lot about the different plants that you're going to be working with as they mature and start to yield.
I just wanted to try and illustrate that, yeah, this can be done with
low technology. We don't have GPS tractors and stuff. It's just hand tools. And if you scaled up the orchard, because that's another thing people ask me, does this scale, how big can you go? And I think it can scale infinitely. You just have to keep putting infinite people in there. You can't have one person doing 1,000 hectares this way. You just need a lot of people doing a little piece each, and you can produce a lot that way with these kind of tools.
So if anybody wants to learn more, they can look at the website, they can come and visit if they want to, and if anyone has any questions about all of that, I realise it's quite a bit taken. That's it. Hopefully that was informative.
No, it's very good. That was really great, revisiting that, because I remember when you and Sam gave your presentation last year, and I started getting a sense of what we were trying to create. Now I can see how much vitality is coming into that system now. And it is, I'm looking at those pictures, it felt alive. And it was such a contrast to that monoculture that you showed at the very start. Modern agriculture, it's not sustainable. We need new models, and this is a great model, food for us. And I love the way it's been quite an evolving thing for you. Like, you started off with one idea, and you've actually been open to new ideas, and you've incorporated these into your system that you've gone. And I think that's been really great.
Is there any sites or soils on that we can't do this with?
There are probably ones with soils and locations that make it harder, but I would say that... I'd say that you can. I think that's an important thing, is that you need to adapt to it. A lot of people go to a site with something already in their mind, like, I'm going to farm sheep here, or I'm going to grow apples here, and they try and force that idea onto the land, rather than looking at the land and going, what could this land actually do? And maybe that's grow olives, or grow figs, or whatever. It's something else they hadn't thought of, but you have to be... open to that, and that's a big part of this and of permaculture generally, is to be open to the feedback that the system is always giving you, and being able to adapt to that as required, because it's that's the best teacher, is to see the changes that are happening and what works and what doesn't. Can take time. And I think a lot of sites can be adapted as well. Like, they can be modified either with earthworks or with the right types of planting as well, you know, to create shade or to create windbreaks or whatever it might be.
Second question.
Yes.
Those log mounds, mm-hmm. I take it from what you said, you buried a log under there, a piece of wood.
Many logs, yes.
And is there any that you wouldn't? Like, there's a lot of pine trees around.
Right. I wouldn't bury live willow, because it'll probably grow. if it's dead, I don't think there's a problem. Depending on what wood you choose, it might break down a lot faster than other woods, or it might not work as well to begin with. I mean, if it's a very solid wood, then it wouldn't absorb much moisture until a long time had gone by. That's why, I mean, I use willow because it's accessible and close, and it's very light, easy to carry, and absorbs a lot of water easily.
What you can
handle, really. Yeah, I mean, we were at Richard's place a couple of weeks ago, and he was showing us his big piles. He doesn't cover them with earth, he just kind of covers them with kitchen scraps and stuff. And he's using, you know, huge rounds of pine, and they just, I mean, it takes sort of 5 years to go through, and he's not creating these log mounds quite like that. He's kind of making a big, long compost, so one end of it's broken down, and he's using that and digging it out and putting it in his garden, and the other end is big, dry logs that have just been cut. So, I mean, there's a few different ways you could go with that. But it's all going to rot down eventually. Yeah, probably the lighter the wood, the quicker you'll be able to benefit from it.